Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Hello, everybody. On today's show, we have two political guests coming from different places. Arthur Brooks, president of the conservative think tank, the American Enterprise Institute, and former Democratic Senator Bill Bradley of New Jersey. And one of the things that we will do is to compare their notions of freedom. Mitt Romney is campaigning heavily on the modern Republican notion of freedom, and Brooks's book called The Road to Freedom takes this libertarian view. He argues we are on the road to serfdom in this country, and he uses that word because of too much government. Bill Bradley thinks otherwise. Here is an example of how Romney uses freedom and uses it on the campaign trail.
I believe one feature of our culture that propels the American economy stands out. Freedom. The American economy is fueled by freedom. Free people and their free enterprises are what drive our economic vitality. The founders wrote that we were endowed by our Creator with the freedom to pursue happiness. In America, we would be free to pursue our own course in life, and we would have economic freedom just as we have political and religious freedom.
So freedom, freedom, freedom. How many times did he say freedom in 30 seconds there, Mitt Romney on the campaign trail? And it looks like a lot of the presidential election this year is being fought over which excesses scare people more, the excesses of government or the excesses of the markets. And the newest entry into this fray comes from Arthur C. Brooks, president of the conservative think tank, the American Enterprise Institute. He makes a moral case, as he frames it, for free enterprise. And the book is called The Road to Freedom, How to Win the Fight for Free Enterprise. Mr. Brooks, welcome back to WNYC.
Hey, Brian. Great to be back with you.
So we just played that clip as you were walking in the door of Mitt Romney at the University of Chicago in March, using the word freedom about a half a dozen times in 30 seconds.
Yeah, for
so
sure.
So you and he are on the same page.
Well, you know, basically, to the extent that I could be on the same page with a politician, they have a tough business. And I run a think tank, which means I can talk in the pure realm of ideas without saying, okay, I'm in, you know, whichever state it is today. They had a factory closed down in this town. I have to be careful on a particular subject. I don't have these particular constraints. So he says freedom a whole lot because this is one of the key values, one of the key moral issues that he's trying to hit. When you play the clip from President Obama at his Kansas speech or his State of the Union, you'll hear him say the word fairness about, you know, 50,000 times within a half-hour space. I mean, basically, these are the themes that they're trying to hit, and that's what I'm trying to dig out in the book.
That's right. So let's make that contrast. Here is 22 seconds of President Obama, also with a values message as he frames it.
Let me tell you, I keep on hearing these same folks talk about values all the time. You want to talk about values? Hard work, that's a value. Looking out for one another, that's a value. The idea that we're all in it together and I'm my brother's keeper and sister's keeper, that's a value.
Both important values, no?
Yeah, for sure. And this is really where this is where liberals have been just taking it to conservatives for a long time. They've been so much more effective about making the moral case. You know, in point of fact, or the way that we talk about politics, the way we think about economics, the way that we build public policy, these are based fundamentally on our values. Liberals have understood this much better and consequently have framed the arguments better. Conservatives who of course base their policies on their values as well have not talked about them in the right way, and this has attenuated their effectiveness. Ultimately, it's led both conservatives and liberals to acquiesce to levels of spending and kinds of public policy that most Americans really don't like.
It's funny because Bill Bradley, who's going to be on with a fairly contrasting message to yours later in the show, writes in his new book how disappointed he was in the Clinton administration in the 90s because Clinton won his second term by abandoning the liberal moral case for government and just trying to institute these small bore programs, while the conservatives continue to pound away on, you know, what he calls the moral framing of the small government message.
Yeah, that's factually not consistent with the way that you see these messages and how they've evolved. The conservatives have been really good at saying free enterprise makes you rich. Free enterprise creates jobs. Free enterprise creates global prosperity. Free enterprise breaks down barriers and does all kinds of good things in the material case. What they've done, what they've been horrible at is saying why we should care about those things. And so, you know, I debate people across the political spectrum all the time. And one of the things that liberals rightly bring up is they say, so why should I care about economic growth? I mean, you keep talking about how great economic growth is, but you never tell me why. Well, we better have an answer for that.
So you won't be unemployed, so you won't be underwater in your mortgage, so your children will have a future, something more than that?
Yeah, well, and even deeper than those things are obviously the reason that we're going to work every day. But there's something about the culture of the United States that we have to remember as well. When you look at, you know, the framers of the Constitution, the men who wrote the Declaration of Independence, these were not materialists. They didn't talk about life, liberty, and the pursuit of highly affordable electrodomestic appliances. They were talking about the pursuit of happiness. This was really a New Age claim. These guys were moralists. So what is the pursuit of happiness? That's the answer that we have to that's the answer that we have to have. And if we're going to exercise our freedom muscles in commerce, which is effectively free enterprise, we better be doing it for the right reasons and protecting it for future generations for the right reasons.
But you want to make the case that something like universal health insurance is a fundamental attack on our moral values, our opportunity to have happiness. But the Democrats could list 15 reasons why it enhances happiness, including that it gives you enough security to go out and take risks in the marketplace rather than being a slave to your employer because you're getting health insurance.
Yeah. Now, the key thing to remember, and one of the things I write about a lot in this book, is that conservatives should never be in the position of saying we want to get rid of the safety net. That's a mistaken position. Virtually nobody agrees with that except people who have relatively extreme ideology. Virtually every conservative that I know believes that we need a strong, reliable safety net. The problem that we have today with everything from universal health care to what we've been doing in regulation to what's been going on with the tax system in this country to all of the dynamics, not just of the past 3 years, which I object to, but of decades going forward, is that this is attenuating the real safety net. These are anti-poor policies. As we go toward a debt crisis, which we certainly will, we will be in the position of Greece. The question is not when or if. The question is when, and it's, you know, 5, 10, 15 years, whatever. You know who's going to be left holding the bag, Brian. It's not you and me. It's not 1%, guys. We're talking about people in the bottom 10% of the people we're commanded to help. So if you love the safety net, you do believe that the pursuit of happiness requires some level of security, you must go toward a responsibility that comes along with the free enterprise system.
I'm going to challenge you on that in a minute. I do want to open up our phones first and let our listeners know that we'll take phone calls for Arthur Brooks. Later, we'll take phone calls for Bill Bradley. And we'll tie it together on your notions of morality and freedom, because they both make moral cases for their different positions. That's certainly one thing that ties these two books and these two guests together, even though they wind up in different places. So let's hear you on your notion of freedom in the 21st century, your notion of political morality in the 21st century for this country. 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692 for Arthur Brooks, president of the American Enterprise Institute. His new book is called The Road to Freedom, How to Win the Fight for Free Enterprise. And, of course, you can post as well to WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show. So when you talk about the policies coming back to haunt the poorer people in this country, why is it that the so-called free enterprise argument seems to give every structural advantage to the better off while claiming it's better for the poor and the middle class? And the list is long. I'll give you a few examples. Don't require employers to pay much of a minimum wage to the working poor. The poor will be better off in the long run. Keep tax rates on the rich low and government services trimmed. It'll be good for the poor in the long run. Warren Buffett's capital gains tax should be taxed at a lower rate, or his capital gains should be taxed at a lower rate than his secretary's salary, to take that famous example. Allow the rich to swamp the political system with unlimited campaign spending, and it will be better for the poor and the middle class. Support so-called free trade, allowing multinational corporations to pit Chinese and Mexican wages against American wages, and it'll be better for the poor and the middle class. It's like all government policy should give advantages to the rich And you argue that it's best for the poor and the middle class.
Yeah. Now, you gave me about 12. So let's just look at number one and number 12.
Okay.
So let's start with the minimum wage. You say in that free enterprise advocates, guys like me, say, look, if you get rid of these minimum wage laws, in the long run, it'll be good for the poor. Here's how to think about it. We know in point of fact that a lot of the restrictions and rigidities that we put on labor markets, they don't affect guys like you and me. They throw out the very people who are most vulnerable in the labor pool. Now, we want to make work pay. So the way to do that is by not going to firms and saying, you must pay them more money, because they will cut jobs. And the people whose jobs they will cut will not be the second earner in a suburban household who happens to be a high school kid. They'll cut the inner city kid who we really most want to have some of these opportunities. If we're going to change labor markets, we need to spend the real money and make work pay with a negative income tax, some other policy, the EITC, something that actually works better. Last of all, free trade. Oh, man. I mean, that's an easy one, Brian. I mean, let's think about it. Since 1980, 80% of the world's worst poverty, which is to say living on a dollar a day or less, 80% has been eradicated. How is that? Is that because of U.S. global foreign aid? Is that because of the United Nations? No, that's because of globalization. That's because of free trade. That's because of global entrepreneurship. In short, free enterprise. In China alone, since 1980, 75% of the world's poverty has been wiped out. 600 million Chinese have been lifted out of poverty. That's because of opening up a free trade. Free trade between the United States and China has increased by 1,000%. People are literally not dying in China. We can talk. I know that there are people who are losing their jobs. I know that there's pain in the United States. But man, if we care about not just the least of these in this country, but the least of these around the world, we have to pay attention to the fact that free trade saves lives.
But and I heard this argument during the NAFTA debate way back in the 90s. Well, look at all the Mexicans who it's going to lift out of poverty. We have to look at this in a global perspective. But is that the role of the U.S. government to try to lift a lot of Chinese people out of policy, out of poverty, even if it reduces wages for the United States, and by the way, increases oil prices, arguably, because of the huge growing middle class in China and the demand that that places on our resources?
One way to we're not putting a policy in place that's sending aid overseas to lift the Chinese up out of poverty. What we're doing is we're getting rid of restrictions that were killing them. That's what we're doing. We're getting rid of something that proactively went out and hurt poor people around the world. That's different than sending them our money.
We will continue in a minute. Our lines are full. We'll start to fold in our callers on this. For Arthur Brooks from the American Enterprise Institute, his new book is called The Road to Freedom, How to Win the Fight for Free Enterprise. Stay with us. Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Your call's next.
We've got to elect a president who puts his faith in free people and free enterprises and in the founding principles that made this country the greatest nation in history. Together, we must restore America's promise by renewing our economic freedom.
Freedom versus fairness, the values debate at the heart of the 2012 presidential election. Mitt Romney at the University of Chicago in March. We're going to put a meter on these guys and see how many times Mitt Romney says freedom between now and November and how many times Barack Obama says fairness.
Right.
And we are talking to Arthur Brooks, first today, president of the Conservative American Enterprise Institute. His new book is called The Road to Freedom, How to Win the Fight for Free Enterprise. Bill Bradley coming up later with another point of view. Jay in Bayshore, you're on WNYC with Arthur Brooks. Hello.
Hello, and thank you for an excellent program, gentlemen. The question I have, and particularly for Mr. Brooks, is in absence of regulation, would the corporations and the people that Mitt Romney seem to support do the right thing? I.e., would General Electric not dump PCBs in the Hudson River had the government said you cannot do this? Whose interest would they take, the public's interest or the interest of their stockholders? And that's the only question I have, because I really believe we need certain government regulations. Otherwise, well, it's proven time and again that corporate America will run amok. Thank you.
Yeah, Jay, nothing to disagree with you on this. We do, in fact, need regulations. There are cases where economists call these things externalities, where people are affected by things outside of market forces and markets fail as a result. If you love free markets and you love free enterprise, you need certain amounts of regulation. The key thing is when regulation is actually getting in the way of how markets can work and enhance people's lives. So you see a lot of the way that we mess around with labor and financial markets and things, they go well beyond these sets of ideas. But in what you said, dropping junk in a river and getting away with it, anybody who's down with that is not facing facts.
But you frame your book as an argument between free enterprise and statism, and that creeping statism is leading the United States down the road to serfdom. It's very either or.
Well, and in point of fact, we do face a choice. Look, the government is supposed to do two basic big things. The first thing the government is supposed to do is to address cases where markets fail. Any good economist, starting with Adam Smith, knew that markets do fail. Monopolies, public goods like the army, externalities like pollution, things like crime. These are market failures, and the government is supposed to do that. Number two, the government is supposed to provide a dependable, reliable safety net for the poorest of the poor. Now, what is that? That's where people really disagree. How high up should it reach? What it's not supposed to do is to socially engineer, to pick political winners and losers, to try to smooth the risk out of life, to make more equality just for the sake of getting more equality. And those are the boondoggles that we're wasting all of our money on today.
So what are some of the biggest market failures that you think the government needs to rightfully deal with in our country today?
The government should deal with antitrust. The government should deal with cases of crime and predation. The government should be providing public goods like the army and basic infrastructure. The government should be looking at cases of, for example, pollution. These are absolutely legitimate things for the government to do. It should also, incidentally, do some cost-benefit analysis to know whether it can solve these problems and whether it can do so cost-effectively. And when it should, that's when I want my government to act. That's where what free enterprise advocates should want the government to do so it can protect the free enterprise system.
Pete in Livingston, you're on WNYC with Arthur Brooks. Hello.
Yes. Hi.
I'm hi. On. Yes, you are.
Hi, Brian. Thank you for taking my call, Brian. Yeah. Okay. So, when you're talking with most libertarians, usually the nonsense is coming fast and furious, so it's hard to keep up with it. But I wanted to pick up on something he said that was more than probably like a throwaway line, but needs to be corrected. And it had to do with the Constitution and the founders, who said life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Now, the funny thing is that where that phrase originally came from was from the philosophy of John Locke, in which the formulation was really life, liberty, and property, not pursuit of happiness. They changed it in the founding, and the founders changed it to pursuit of happiness from pursuit of property.
And what's the relevance?
Because they didn't want to make it look like they were going to take away the property of the loyalists to the king during the revolution. So, that needs to be corrected. It had nothing to do with the founders being New Age non-materialists, as the guest had said. That needs to be corrected.
All right. Well, how much do you agree with that?
Well, zero. I mean, our caller began by suggesting that with guys like me, the nonsense comes fast and furious, but I'll try not to give you nonsense fast nor furiously. The language from the Declaration of Independence from the second paragraph actually was adapted from the Virginia Declaration of Rights, which was submitted 3 weeks earlier by George Mason. And that emphasized life, liberty, and as the guest correctly points out, the possession of property. It also mentioned the pursuit of happiness. The possession of property was dropped in the interim 3 weeks by Thomas Jefferson. No one exactly knows why. There is some discussion of the fact that the possession of property was seen to be insufficiently moral to elicit the struggle, maybe even death, for what was nothing more than an experiment at the time. So I would assert that in point of fact, this was a profoundly moral document.
You try to make a moral case in your book based partly on merit. Does that mean if you're a more market-based system that produces more inequality, it's because the poor deserve to be poor and the middle class deserve to be stagnant?
No, not at all. And actually, this brings up a really important point. We don't want to frame it freedom versus fairness. That's a mistaken construction. And we tend to do it all the time because Mitt Romney talks a whole lot about freedom and Barack Obama talks a lot about fairness. If you look at public opinion polling, if you look at most data on how people feel about fairness, they fundamentally reject the way Obama is talking about what fairness means. in the 14 times in his Kansas speech that he mentioned fairness, and the 9 times in his State of the Union speech, every case referred to redistributive fairness. Every case referred to trying to rectify inequality for the sake of rectifying inequality. And this is something that people who believe in the free enterprise system very strongly, as I do, need to take the game to that and say, you've defined fairness wrong. True fairness means creating an opportunity society, which can be very expensive. But it also means rewarding merit. It means lifting people up for their hard work and their innovation. Now, I realize that that's sometimes controversial.
But is your argument that the market will do that? Because that's the heart of the conservative argument in a way, right? Don't make me pay taxes to give other people food stamps. They're poor because they're morally deficient.
I've never heard a self-respecting conservative say that. I would never assert that we should not pay taxes to pay for food stamps because people are morally deficient. That's why they need them. What I am saying, I don't want to speak for everybody.
I hear it from some callers who will call up and say, look, all this, you know, food stamps and extended unemployment, all of that, people are lazy. If you made this less, then people would work harder. That it is a question of merit and morality in that respect in a lot of the conservative public's mind.
Now, extended unemployment benefits and food stamps, you've just conflated two very, very different policies, of course. One of the things that we find is that temporary aid and long-term extended aid do very different things to people. And this is the heart of the moral case for free enterprise. It's not punishing people who are poor. We're trying to figure out how we can best dignify individuals, how each one can pursue their happiness. I believe that every single person deserves earned success. Does that mean we need no government? Of course not. Does that mean we need no safety net? Absolutely not. It would be morally reprehensible for us to step away from the safety net. And that's another moral promise of the free enterprise system, is a sustainable economic base where we can guarantee it for hundreds of years.
But wait, extended unemployment benefits in an extended unemployment crisis in America leads to laziness?
No, that's not what I'm saying at all. What I'm saying is that extended unemployment benefits, it's empirically verified. We have many studies showing that when you have extended unemployment benefits, that on its face actually hurts the ability of the economy to recover. And of course, who does that hurt? That doesn't hurt you and me. That hurts the very people that we're trying to help. Now, I realize that the easiest thing to do always is to relieve suffering by giving money in the short term. But we have to be more strategic about that. We have to be smarter about that. Sometimes we even have to spend a little bit more money to create more opportunity as opposed to simply putting a Band-Aid on these problems.
But it's still a moral argument, isn't it? If you're saying more unemployment benefits leads to more long-term unemployment, then you must be saying it's a moral hazard that people who can stay on those longer-term unemployment benefits, meager as they may be, do not have the moral fiber to go out and find a job, even a low-paying, crappy job.
No. See, you're still misunderstanding me just a little bit, Brian. I'm saying that it's immoral to do so, not because it emphasizes the poor moral fiber of the poor themselves, or it allows them to continue to be lazy or something. What I'm saying is it hurts them. The very moral problem that we have with many of these government programs, the reason we should be significantly interested in them, is because they actually help the people they hurt the people they're supposed to help. When I was a kid, I grew up under very austere economic circumstances. About a quarter of the people in my neighborhood were probably on welfare, as a matter of fact. Here's something we all knew. I mean, I grew up in a lower class neighborhood in Seattle. Here's what we all knew. The welfare system was screwing up the lives of those people. In 1984, when Charles Murray wrote his famous book, Losing Ground, that was a controversial thing to say. By 1996, when Bill Clinton incredibly courageously signed welfare reform legislation, it was conventionally understood that the old and great society welfare system was hurting the people it's supposed to help. We're not talking about dumping on people who are lazy because they're poor. We're talking about not hurting them.
You have a very interesting background, by the way. People who don't know, Arthur Brooks, president of the American Enterprise Institute. You talk about growing up in a lower middle class neighborhood. You dropped out of college to become a classical French horn player.
Yeah.
Played with the Barcelona City Symphony for a number of years, and then became a conservative economist. That's a heck of a road.
Yeah, this is the promise of the free enterprise system. You mean the imagination is what your limit is ultimately, at least for a lot of people. I don't mean to minimize the fact that a lot of people are suffering, and I was very lucky. But I did start out as a musician, and I did that until I was 31 years old and then became an economist.
What happened when you started spouting conservative ideology in the midst of a lot of classical musicians?
Actually, it was worse spouting those ideas in the midst of my parents. You know, I grew up in a liberal democratic household in Seattle, and I remember at one point I was about 28 years old, and I'd been reading subversive ideas from conservative thinkers like Hayek and Friedman. And my mother, she took me aside and she said, "Arthur, I have to ask you a personal question." This is never good when your mother says that. She said, "Be honest with me. Have you been voting for Republicans?"
The presumably voting for Republicans, Arthur C. Brooks, president of the American Enterprise Institute and the author now of The Road to Freedom, How to Win the Fight for Free Enterprise, and David in Brooklyn. You're on WNYC. Hello, David.
Oh, hello. I find your guest very humorous. Because of the things that he says are so patently ridiculous. Now, for example, he keeps saying free enterprise. See, that sounds nice. People like free movies, free candy, but it's a euphemism for capitalism. Why don't they use the real name, capitalism? See, for some reason, it doesn't sound too good.
Well, you don't shrink from the word capitalism, do you?
No, I mean, whatever. Capitalism is fine. Incidentally, that was coined by Karl Marx, and it was used as a pejorative term. So I suppose in some deconstructionist way, I could turn that word on. I don't care. We call it whatever we want.
But your notion, you mentioned Hayek.
Yeah.
And David, thank you for your call. Your notion of the road to serfdom, the opposite of the road to freedom, you frame it as free enterprise versus statism, which sounds like we're still in the Cold War. Didn't free enterprise already win? And the only question is how much to regulate its excesses?
Actually, free enterprise has slowly been losing, in point of fact. If you go back the past 75 years, you see constant incremental free enterprise receding, and it doesn't depend on whether Democrats or Republicans are in control of Congress or the White House. So my institution was founded in 1938, the American Enterprise Institute, with the idea that the government was controlling too much of the economy, and that was getting in the way of entrepreneurs who wanted to earn their success. That was when the government controlled 15% of American GDP, all levels of government. Today it's 36%. According to the Congressional Budget Office, that'll be 50% by the year 2038. Now I know we have a lot of progressive listeners today, but I bet you that not very many of them like the idea of working from January 1st through June 30th for a government that they don't particularly love.
Well, yet your notion of the road to serfdom, which is Friedrich Hayek's notion, serfdom, sees Americans as a kind of servitude in a kind of servitude to this ever-expanding government, as you were just saying. But I could just as easily argue that most Americans are on a road to an ever-expanding corporatocracy that holds all the cards in our economy. Are you not afraid of that too?
I'm horribly afraid of that. In point of fact, the twin threats to American liberty and the twin threats to a fundamental fairness in our society are statism and corporate cronyism. You look around and there's special deals for everybody, be they public sector unions or companies that have the best K Street lobbyists and lawyers and accountants that are getting bailouts or they're getting special deals and special carve-outs in the tax code. It's just not right. You know, this is something where the Tea Party and the Occupy protesters, where they really should come together and agree that these threats to liberty and basic fairness shouldn't stand.
But it's not just special breaks in the tax codes to some corporations. Have you read Steve Call's new book yet? From the New America Foundation about ExxonMobil. He says that companies like ExxonMobil are becoming so powerful that they're their own sovereigns, and they're more powerful now than the governments that they deal with, even the superpower governments.
Yeah, I mean, the threat of largeness is, it alarms some people more than others. What bugs me the most about large and growing corporations is the extent to which our government—
Large and unaccountable is his argument.
Okay, and we have a too-big-to-fail set of policies from this government. I mean, come on, where the government basically says, you're too big to fail, so we're not going to let you fail. Man, too big to fail means too big.
Jay in Brooklyn. You're on WNYC. Hello, Jay.
Hi, good morning. I'm a fiscal conservative. I admire Hayek and Friedman, and I agree with you that the government is getting too much in the way of our personal freedom. But I want to ask this question. Recently in their House budget, the House Republicans voted to make relatively modest cuts in our social programs, which I'm in support of, but they did not vote to cut agricultural subsidies, and most of those subsidies go to big agricultural corporations. Why what is the difference really between them and the Democrats? Aren't they just offering a slightly different version of big government?
Yes, Jay, you are correct. And this is the biggest problem. This is why we've been marching down this road to serfdom, because we have two parties, one that wants to spend all of your money and one that wants to spend only, you know, 10% less of your money on these types of boondoggles. The fact that we still have these crazy agricultural policies that hurt the poor, that are not good for free enterprise, is simply it's a lack of courage.
You used the term redistribution of wealth, as if it's only about a big bad government taking money that people have earned and giving it to people who don't deserve it. But hasn't the big redistribution of wealth in the last 30 years come in the marketplace? You know the numbers about how few Americans have how much of the wealth and make how much of the income compared to 30 years ago?
Sure, I do. And so if you look, for example, you'll find that in about 1980, the top 5% made 21% of the total income. By 2009, it was 35% of the total income. But you'll also find that that number, the percentage of the taxes that the bottom 5% or the top 5% were paying in 1980 was 35%. Today, it's 59%. So you find that the tax burden has more than kept pace with the income distribution. When we focus single-mindedly, as apparently the president is doing, on income inequality as a social problem, we don't help the poor, and we're actually thrown off the big social issue of our time. The social issue of our time, besides freedom, as Mitt Romney and others are talking about, is not income inequality. It's income mobility, which is not high enough. This is something that conservatives and liberals should agree on and tackle.
But, you know, I think the problem goes beyond taxation. And people may quibble with your numbers about what percentage of taxes are paid by whom. But the argument, and the argument by the Democrats and Republicans today, seems to revolve around relative income tax rates, and it seems to get left there. But what about the shortcomings of the free enterprise system in terms of distributing on the basis of merit, right? It's a funny time in our nation's history to be sort of making a merit argument, isn't it? Citigroup shareholders just voted against CEO's pay because they believe pay had become disconnected from merit on Wall Street. The Dodd-Frank reform enabled them to do that. CEOs used to make 40 times the lowest paid employees. Now it's 400 times. And I don't think many people in America actually believe that merit has actually concentrated in such few hands over time.
Yeah, and I'm really glad to see that a private corporation, without being threatened by the government, without being browbeaten by politicians and bureaucrats, can actually say, you know what, I think this CEO is not worth this much money, and as a result, take this action. That's an example of the free enterprise system working.
So from what I've read, it was a provision of the Dodd-Frank Wall Street regulation bill that enabled them to actually make that statement as shareholders when people who say they're supporting free markets want to repeal Dodd-Frank.
No, in fact, there have been these shareholder movements for a long time. There have been a lot of boards of directors that have been saying that this has been getting out of hand. And in fact, there's a lot of malfeasance and greed and a lot of improvements that need to be made in corporate governance. Guarantee you that when the government gets in the way of that by actually setting the rules, we will set back the progress in those movements.
Why do you think we have such concentration of wealth?
We have the concentration of wealth in this country for a number of different reasons, the biggest of which is that as the economy has been more technologically oriented, we see a run-up in the returns to expertise, the returns to education, and that is disproportionately going to be found in the top 5% of the population. That's number one. In other words, the structure of the global economy, the structure of the technological economy is disproportionately materially rewarding the top. Now, that also rewards others, but it means the inequality actually gets bigger. That's number one. Number two is we're holding down the bottom 20% of the income distribution. This is the mobility problem in a nutshell. One of the biggest inequality problems we've got in this country is that the 20% and the bottom are having a harder and harder time getting ahead. Read Charles Murray's new book, Coming Apart. I'm sure you have. It was a big bestseller this spring. And what it says is that we're doing a lot of things wrong. We have a civil rights crisis in the way that we do public schooling that disproportionately doesn't hurt your kids and my kids. It disproportionately hurts the kids in the bottom fifth. We don't train them in entrepreneurship. We have public schools that are designed for grown-ups, not for kids. And furthermore, we don't even deal with cultural issues that are actually holding people down.
You know, I was reading about social mobility this morning, and I'm glad you brought it up, because I think when we talk about income inequality, a lot of what's really important there has to do with where the bottom is. If a few people at the top are really, really rich, it doesn't hurt anybody necessarily as compared to their being extraordinarily, extraordinarily rich, as long as there's a thriving middle class and there's mobility for the bottom. But that seems to be stagnating too. I'm not sure about Charles Murray's numbers. I was reading a study this morning, and forgive me, I can't cite the source, but I wrote down the numbers. The countries with less of what you might call freedom, Scandinavian ones, Canada, Australia, have more social mobility than the United States, measured by the percentage of people born to the bottom 20% of income parents or top 20% parents who moved out of those groups in the next generation.
Yeah.
Do you accept those stats, and why do you think that is?
I do accept those stats, and there are a couple of reasons for that. Number one is that these are countries that have very narrow income bands to begin with. So mobility between the percentile. I mean, the arithmetic is a little bit hairy, but basically when you don't have very much spread in your income distribution, moving between the income bands is pretty easy. That's the main reason that we have higher income mobility in certain European countries than we do have here in the United States. Second of all, some of these countries like Sweden have been much better at dealing with how they're going to help people in the bottom 20% of the income distribution. You notice that Sweden has been trying to liberalize its economic policies for a long time. It's been moving away from cradle to grave coverage in a lot of their welfare coverage. It's going in the opposite direction of what we're doing in the United States. And the result of that is that it's actually creating more opportunity and growth for people in the bottom 20%, and that enhances mobility.
We're just about out of time. Bill Bradley will be coming up later in the show with a very different take on the state of the United States and what we need right now. I just want to read you one passage from his book about Ronald Reagan. And he writes, as it turned out, Reagan did not shut down government. There was more stability than revolution during those years. Reagan accepted catastrophic health insurance for the elderly. When his 1981 tax cut proved a fiscal nightmare, he agreed to the largest tax increase in our peacetime history. While his actions to promote the common good have largely been forgotten by the general public, his anti-government rhetoric has not, and he is repeatedly invoked as a Tea Party icon. But the real Reagan would flunk the no new taxes litmus test required of today's Republican candidates. What do you say to Bill Bradley in advance?
Well, the point is completely overstated. The idea that somebody would stand against catastrophic health care for the elderly. Come on. I mean, this is this classic thing. When Paul Ryan came out with his budget, that was very, very Reaganite. You know, the people from labor unions were running commercials that showed Paul Ryan pushing a lady over a cliff on a wheelchair. Give me a break. All they're talking about is lowering the rate of growth of Medicare. Everybody wants catastrophic health insurance for old people. What we don't want is an open-ended spending commitment for middle-class people who have never paid as much into the system as they're taking out. Is that so much to ask?
And on Reagan raising taxes?
Reagan raised taxes, and would that stand today according to the current economic circumstances? I don't know. I'm pretty confident, however, that the Reagan philosophy of growth fundamentally is helping the poor would stand up today, and he'd be pretty warmly accepted.
Well, the discussion continues. We could do this all day. We could fold in 25 more people and do it between now and November. And one segment at a time on this show, we will. And we thank Arthur C. Brooks, president of the American Enterprise Institute, for talking about the ideas in his new book, The Road to Freedom, How to Win the Fight for Free Enterprise. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Brian. It's great to be with you.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Bill Bradley coming up a little while. And as I said before, we will talk to him not only about how we can all do better, which is the title of his new book. We'll also ask him what it was like being with Jeremy Lin of his time, an Ivy Leaguer who made it to become a star on the Knicks. But coming up next, we will look at the possibility that a substance you know little about could be the key to our energy independence. It's called thorium. Stay with us.